It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Curious Wisconsin. We'll visit a Kenosha track that's been hosting bicycle racing for over eight decades.
But first, online security researchers in Milwaukee say Russian hackers are in possession of 1.2 billion username and password combinations. In addition, 500 million email addresses have also been stolen.
The researchers wouldn't say who the victims are. There has been some skepticism in the security field about some of the claims. But some major companies say they are aware that their records are among the stolen information. In some quarters, it's renewed the debate over whether to get rid of the whole password concept entirely, replace passwords with some more effective security methods.
David Gewertz of UC Berkeley is with us. He is a cybersecurity expert and contributing editor at ZDNet.com. David, welcome to Central Time.
Well, hello. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, but there are a whole bunch of people out there with their passwords perhaps compromised, their online identities may be out there for everyone to see, so they might not be doing so well. The question I have for you, since we learned about this story, since it broke a couple days ago, have we learned anything else new?
Well, yeah, we know that there's a pretty good chance that this is a true story, that this wasn't made up. The security researchers who made the original claim are pretty vetted folks. And the other fact is that we can almost always assume that our passwords have been compromised one way or the other, regardless of whether it's this incident or others. Our passwords are constantly being scooped up and are being made available through usually organized crime organizations.
Yeah, so two questions for you. How do they go about scooping up all of this information? And it's vast, vast amounts of data. What do they do with it then to make it sort of saleable?
Well, the short form answer for your first question is that many websites and computer systems have security flaws. And the bad guys use a wide library of exploits to tunnel their way in and capture that information. And it's usually done through automated systems, but sometimes they'll lock onto some very large database and bring it down. But it's usually some small security flaw that wasn't put into place by some organization somewhere that gives them the entry point. As for what they do with them, they're often sold to other groups who then make use of them. And sometimes they're sold in kits with full identity information, including social security numbers and backgrounds and medical histories. Other times they're simply sold as access information that can be used, for example, to go into an email account and use that email account to send spam to all the contacts on that email account, or to send malware to each of those contacts so that those machines can become basically zombie computers, botnets in the field, things like that. So it's really, if you think about it, a giant distribution channel for digital badness.
So as we look at all of this and you start thinking about the idea of passwords, this does raise the question of how viable this whole idea of having a user ID, having a password is. Tell me what you think of the current password user ID combination, how effective it is, and whether that's the future or whether we should be looking at something else.
We definitely need to be looking at something else. The username and password are, for all intents and purposes, obsolete. Not only can do dumps like this grab existing usernames and passwords, they also give criminals enough data so that they can predict how we choose usernames and passwords using something called predictive modeling. So what we really advise is at this moment using something called multi-factor authentication, which really is something you know, something you have, and something you are. So the password is something you know. Something you have might be your smartphone or a key or something like that. So if you're a Google user, or a Facebook user, or many, many online sites now will offer a second way to authenticate, and we strongly recommend you use it, even though it's a bit of a pain to go ahead and do so, because that means that even if they get your username and password, they won't have the little time-based code you have to type into your phone, and it will help protect you.
So that's when they call your smartphone, and then you type that number in, that kind of thing you mean?
Right.
Okay.
Yep. That's one of those variations on what you have. In this case, you have the smartphone.
So let's say that this, to me, though, has kind of a stopgap feel to it, this whole multi-factor authentication. So this will hold us for how long before we have to move on to whatever the next technology is? Or are we already too late?
We're too late.
Okay.
It'll hold on for a while. But, I mean, we are most definitely at risk. And we're finding that some of the firms are looking at mechanisms that bypass individual security mechanisms on their own and sort of do what's called federated security. And corporations will do that so that you are not using a username or password to get into any of the corporate systems. You're using some kind of authentication system. And we'll be seeing that over time, but you're looking at millions and millions of different people accessing millions and millions of different systems, and it's a feeding frenzy for criminals.
So what do you see the future looking like? Are we talking about, you know, more fingerprint types of IDs, retina scans, that sort of thing, or is there something else that I'm missing entirely here?
Well, you know, the Apple fingerprint identification method is one method. I think that, you know, as we go further and further into this, we may even, and this is really science fiction-y, so, you know, take this with a grain of salt. You know, you may see things like subcutaneous implants that are tied to an individual. But every one of those things, whether it's a fingerprint or an implant or anything else, requires a key on the other side to match it, which means that there's always a source for compromise. So this is really going to be an arms race. And I think the fundamental message of this is you got to keep up with whatever the latest technology and security that's being offered by your vendors are and use it, even if it's a pain, and then realize that this is an arms race, that every time that we add a protection, there are people out there who see billions of dollars who want to get through that protection and take advantage of it.
Yeah, I've heard that term before, the whole arms race concept, and it's always followed by – it always seems like the hackers are ahead in the arms race. Is that true?
Yep. Yeah, because remember, we have to defend against everything, and all they have to do is get into your account.
So given all that, it sounds like I don't want to say bleak, but it sounds like a complicated future for anybody who lives online these days, and these days it's almost anybody. Is our online existence, the places we spend, whether it's on email or Facebook or whatever it might be, is it just going to get more complicated and we just have to learn to live with that?
Yep. It's kind of like the first drivers that were on roads didn't have traffic jams and traffic signals and, you know, speed limits. But today, if you want to commute into New York City, you still have to make it through the Holland Tunnel.
Mm-hmm. So in the short term, for the people who have heard the news stories from the last week or two and they haven't done anything with their passwords, should they be going back and doing something right now?
It's always good to regularly change your password for sensitive accounts, whether it's a bank account or your email. Your email is your gateway to almost everything. So if you have password or 123000 as your password, you need to change it yesterday. And make sure you set up multi-factor authentication for that if you haven't. I would say that that's an immediate action that you should be doing, regardless of this piece of news or not. If you're using a weak password or you're not using multi-factor authentication on your email, you should do it immediately.
And so let's say you've already been hacked. And is there anything else you can do except just contact everybody in the world and let them know?
Well, again, you're going to want to clean your account. You're going to want to change your stuff. Most important is you want to start keeping an eye on your finances. You know, check your credit cards. Make sure you contact the bank. Cancel your credit cards. Keep an eye on your insurance as well, because we're seeing an awful lot of healthcare fraud going through this stuff. So being proactive about your financial affairs becomes really important, especially if you've been hacked. And of course, you know, contact law enforcement if you feel that that's something you want to involve them in.
Okay, lots to think about. David Gurwitz, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Good luck, everybody.
Yeah, we have. I think we've been talking with David Gurwitz, a cybersecurity expert and a contributing editor at ZDNet.com.
Competitive bicycle racing on a track was once a major spectator sport in the United States, and Wisconsin was no exception.
In this week's Curious Wisconsin, we check out the Washington Park Velodrome in Kenosha. It's been in operation for over 80 years, and it still hosts races today.
Len Caballero has been racing at the Velodrome for a few decades, and he's worked as race director and organizer at the Washington Park Velodrome. Len, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rob. Appreciate the time to speak with you.
Well, first of all, I wasn't familiar when I first heard about this. I didn't even know what a velodrome is. It was a new word to me. What is a velodrome?
A velodrome is a bicycle track, or a track, like a running track, that's made for bicycle racing. The difference between a running track and a bicycle track is it's typically banked in the corners to allow higher speeds through the turns.
Okay, and what kind of, how steep is that pitch on these banks?
Well, the track in Kenosha starts at about 27 degrees, and some of the newer tracks that they use at the, you know, the international level, and, you know, even there's one in Chicago that's has about over 50 degrees of banking.
Wow, so you're going pretty fast to stay up on that, I imagine.
You do. You need a track like that. You have to be pedaling about 20 miles an hour to stay upright. On our track in Kenosha, it's a you don't have to have that type of a speed. It's not that steep.
Well, let's get into the history of velodromes in the U.S. How big were they? When did they first come about?
Velodrome racing actually started back in the late 1880s, 1890s, and it was one of the biggest professional sports at the time. You know, some of the highest paid athletes, some of the highest attended events were these bicycle races at major places, you know, Chicago Amphitheater, Madison Square Garden, and, you know, all over the country. They were the top riders in the world would come and race their bikes.
So this was a big spectator sport.
It was in the time. You know, it would fill arenas just like current professional sports do today.
And the people who were racing, they were kind of the sports stars of the day.
They were, you know, one of the greatest ones of all time. You know, there was a lot of them. Was this person, Major Taylor from Indianapolis, and, you know, he made at the time, you know, more money than any professional athlete in the world.
Well, now take us into Kenosha. How far back does the velodrome go there?
In the Kenosha Velodrome, Washington Park Velodrome, it opened in 1927. So currently, it's the oldest continually operating velodrome in the U.S. You know, it shut down for a few years during World War II, but since then, you know, that's 87 years of race history that we have in Kenosha.
So what is it about Kenosha and the velodrome? Why did it stick around there?
One of the big reasons it stuck around is, you know, it had a history. You know, some of the big riders came from the Kenosha, Chicago, Milwaukee area, but also the support that the city of Kenosha gives. You know, it's a landmark. You know, being the oldest velodrome in the U.S. at this time, you know, the city can, you know, treats it like a landmark and helps us, you know, care for the track by, you know, fixing, repairing, you know, just simple things like mowing the lawn and making the facilities for, you know, riders of all ages to come down and enjoy.
And, Len, how did you first get involved in the velodrome there?
I started riding at in the stock bike program on a Monday night. I was a cross-country runner at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and was injured and used bicycle riding as rehab and just started enjoying riding more than running, so became involved with the Monday night program back in 1985.
Back in 1985. Now, that Monday night program, it's still running, it sounds like. How can anybody just show up with any old bike and give it a try?
Yeah, the Monday night stock bike program, it starts, you know, with children 3 years old. If you can pedal a big wheel or a bicycle or any bicycle or anything, you can come and ride on the warm-up circle, which is where we have the younger age group children ride. And then they graduate to the larger track at 7, 8 years old, where, you know, the track that the adults race on, and all the way up to 60 years old. You know, so there's a big range. Bring your bike, have a helmet, and you can race.
So on any given Monday, how many people tend to show up and give it a try?
Well, there's usually 40 to 50 different people racing. Last year, we had about 120 different people showing up to race, which is pretty nice for a development program.
And then, so that's where people can show up and give it a try. I gather that Tuesday night is the big spectator sport night. What happens on Tuesdays in season?
Tuesday nights is a USA Cycling sanction series. So those are the guys that you see racing. You know, when you see a bike race all over, there's the sanctioning event of this of bicycle racing. So we have about 40 to 60 people, again, racing, all age categories, starting from 9 years old. And some of the oldest people racing still competitively at that are, you know, 60 years old and coming out and racing.
Wow. And do you get, is it still a big spectator sport when you do it there?
Not like it was. You know, in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, we have challenges now, I believe, you know, Xbox and, you know, a lot of other things going on out there to keep people at home more. But there's good nights. You know, we have some main events through the season that we get some great promotion and more people coming down.
Are we seeing a return of velodromes? Are you hearing about them opening up elsewhere in the country now?
Well, there are. You know, velodrome racing there has been growing over the last few years. You know, one opened up in Chicago about 3 years ago. One just opened up in Boulder, Colorado. This was the first season for them. You know, so you'll see them popping up. It looks like there's one in Cleveland, one in South Carolina. So it's exciting to see the resurgence of that track racing.
Do you think you're getting to a critical mass where there's more velodromes, there's more racers, and maybe more of an audience for it?
I think that would be, you know, the more exposure people get, it'll just drive more people to racing. You know, one thing I tell people about racing, you know, at the track, you know, there's road races that you see, you know, like the Tour de France and the Criterium racing. Those guys go out and they race, you know, their event, and they have one finish a night. At the track, you know, a guy like, you know, say a junior, 14 years old, he has the opportunity to race and compete seven different times a night in different categories. So you're racing and, you know, racing an event, you know, a minimum of 2-3 times, up to 5-6, depending on your age group.
You know, Len, I just thought of what's maybe a stupid question. I keep going back and forth between picturing this in an enclosed amphitheater and outside. Is this an indoor or an outdoor sport?
It's both. The one in Kenosha is outdoor, so the season runs, you know, during the summer, May through you know, early September. There's one in Los Angeles, the ADT, which is the Olympic Training Center version, and that one is year-round. You know, it's enclosed. They control the humidity. They control the temperature. You know, so it goes from your outdoor track to, you know, high-tech indoor.
Now, we've talked a little bit about the stock bikes. You can show up with your own bike. How about the pros? What's special about the bikes they use?
Well, the pros have to ride a bike called it's a fixed-gear bike. So it's one gear, no brakes.
No brakes.
No shifters. No brakes, no shifters. Yeah, that it's kind of imposing when you first talk about it, but it just gives you a lot of control. It's direct drive pedaling to go forward, and you back pressure the pedals to slow down. And, you know, no one is going to hit the brakes, so you run right into the maximum.
Oh, okay. So it's a case where
controlled.
Brakes might make us less safe in this case.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, that's what I like to say after racing for all the years. It's, you know, everyone is under control, you know, pretty much.
So if we're in the Kenosha area on a Tuesday night during the season, what do we see when we go in to check out the event as a spectator?
Well, you come down to Washington Park Velodrome, and you see there's a hill. The nice thing about Kenosha is it's set in along a hill. So the track is at the bottom of the hill, and the seating is you bring your blanket or your lawn chairs and you sit in the grass around. So it's like the Alpine Valley lawn seats, I guess, would equate that to.
Huh.
You'll see racing starting at 7, all age categories. So you'll have the little tykes that'll, you know, our future Olympians at 9, 10, 11, 12 years old to, you know, all the junior categories to seniors and, you know, masters racing at guys racing at 40, 50, 60 years old still.
All right. Sounds like a lot of fun. Len, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the time. And everyone come on down to Kenosha.
That was Len Caballero with the Washington Park Velodrome in Kenosha. For the racing schedule, we've put up a link to the Velodrome. You can check out that Monday night and Tuesday night ride. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page to find that information. We continue now with our week-long series of candidate forums in advance of next week's primary elections across Wisconsin. Earlier this week, we spoke with the primary challengers in the 4th and 7th congressional districts, as well as the Democratic candidates in the Attorney General race. Now we turn to the Office of State Treasurer. It's an open race that's attracted a handful of candidates, some who want to reform the office and at least one who wants to eliminate it. There are two Democrats and two Republicans running in next week's primary. We'll be talking with all four over the next hour. We start with Dave Leeper. He's a Madison-based attorney and former Greene County district attorney. He's a Democratic candidate for state treasurer. He joins us here in the studio. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be on Wisconsin Public Radio.
So the basics, why do you want to be the next state treasurer here in Wisconsin?
Well, I got into the campaign for treasurer because I'm concerned about an underlying inequality of wealth and income that is increasing in our society. I feel that this inequality threatens our economy. It stifles our economy. It threatens our environment. It's responsible for creating strip mines and frack sand mines. And it threatens our democracy because we have wealthy billionaires buying our elections in Wisconsin and writing our laws. Now, we don't have to let that happen. We can control our own money in Wisconsin. And to me, that's the treasurer's job. The treasurer should be the watchdog, should be the people's advocate in terms of our financial health. That's why I'm running for Wisconsin state treasurer.
So some have made the case that the position should be eliminated, including one candidate in this election, the incumbent who's not running for office again when he was running. Some in the state legislature say, we don't need this job. We should get rid of it. Make the case that the position of state treasurer still matters.
Well, I would say that generally Republicans have voted in the assembly to abolish this constitutional office. And I often say that the Koch brothers would like a weak and ineffectual state treasurer or no treasurer at all. They don't want anybody to watch Wisconsin's money. I am concerned that we have to do that, and to allow this office to be eliminated and to concentrate all of this power in the governor's office, which is what they've done over the last decade. They've stripped this office from its powers, and they've concentrated that in the governor's office. We don't need a more powerful governor in Wisconsin. So I'm ready to stand up and to watch the governor and make sure our money is invested and spent wisely.
Over the years, that legislature, as you say, has taken a lot of the duties and responsibilities away from the treasurer's office. What specific duties, jobs would you like to see restored to the office or added to it?
Well, I believe that you're probably aware that the backlog of the unclaimed property has been a serious issue. Unclaimed property was taken out of the treasurer's office just about a year ago, and the backlog has increased, I believe, 6 or 7 times what it was when the state treasurer handled it. So obviously, taking care of the unclaimed property and taking back responsibility for the EdVest program, for educational investments for families, those are important, but those are not the heart of the treasurer's responsibility. The heart of the treasurer's responsibility is to report on the financial health of Wisconsin. And we are not in good shape. We are seeing smokes and mirrors on our financial situation. Governor Walker, you know, told us we have a state surplus after he increased borrowing $1.5 billion. You know, he created bonds to get $1.5 billion. And then he said, well, we have a couple million extra. Let's give it all back. You know, that's a cheap political gimmick. And we need a treasurer accountable to the people to expose things like that. That's the heart of the treasurer's office. These other services are good. They're important. The treasurer's office has always done them well. but they're not the heart of this office. And creating a Bank of Wisconsin is the true heart of my program as Wisconsin State Treasurer.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about. That's been a main point, as you say, in your campaign. What would a State Bank of Wisconsin look like?
Well, the best way, first of all, for your listeners, I would like to let you know that my website is witreasurer.org. You can go on my website. You can read about public banking. You can read about what a Bank of Wisconsin could do. You can read that over 20 states are looking into the creation of a public bank. But the real example that we have is the state of North Dakota. North Dakota has had a public bank since 1919. And they created that bank because they were being squeezed by the Wall Street banks as farmers. Farmers have to borrow money to put their crops in. The Wall Street banks were charging them high interest and high fees. So they created a state bank. It has served them for nearly 100 years. And let me tell you a couple ways it has. The Bank of North Dakota contributed over $300 million in profits to the state of North Dakota in the last 10 years. And that's in a state of 600,000 people. You can imagine what we could do here in Wisconsin. North Dakota just started a program where they're going to allow any student to consolidate student loans at 1.75% interest. My daughter's repaying her student loans at 6.8% interest, and she's not allowed to even refinance that. We have a student debt crisis, and Bank of Wisconsin can address that crisis. We can invite our students, our young people, to stay in Wisconsin, not take off for Chicago and Minneapolis like they're doing right now.
If you're elected, there's a good chance that the state legislature will still be in Republican control. How would you work with them to pursue this idea of a state bank? Would there be skepticism there that you think you could overcome?
Well, North Dakota is not a bastion of liberalism. North Dakota is a conservative Republican state. Bank of Wisconsin makes good business interest for everybody in Wisconsin. And I know that there are some good Republican legislators who will understand that. This is not a partisan issue. This is a matter of regaining control of our money, which we are shipping off to the large investment banks, and we don't have to do that. We can keep it right here, working Wisconsin to build community, to create the kind of world where our children will want to live. That's what we need.
And as state treasurer, for the things you're talking about, whether it's this public bank, creating more accountability, you say, to be a watchdog for the state budget, given the limited powers in the office, how do you leverage that position to get anything done?
Well, I've been talking all around the state for the last 8 months, and I've spoken with people in many different settings. And there's an excitement about regaining control of our finances. People understand. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, has told us that the system is rigged and the American people get it. They get it right down to their toes. I believe they do. And I believe if we have a treasurer who will go out and offer alternatives and programs and hold hearings all around the state, you know, we are going to be able to implement public banking. We are going to put a control on the money that we spend out, that we send out to investment banks. Let me give you one example here in Dane County. Somebody did a study for Dane County in which they found that in the last 10 years, Dane County spent about $80 million on financing costs. You know, anytime you want to buy some new equipment or put up a new building, You borrow money. If they would have had their own Bank of Dane County, they would have reduced those costs in half, $40 million. Dane County would have had $40 million either to reduce taxes, which I hope the Republicans will appreciate, or to increase programs. So this program makes sense for everybody. I think it's going to take off. It's going to be the winning issue in this campaign.
We've talked about the issues, what you do on the job. Could you talk a little bit about your background, your career, and how it sets you up to be the state treasurer?
Sure. I guess one reason I'm running for state treasurer is I've grown up in a political household. My mother was Midge Leeper Miller. She was a state representative from Madison for many years. My brother is State Senator Mark Miller. And actually, my grandmother and my great-grandfather were both elected officials in Washburn County. So when I was elected district attorney, I became the fourth generation of elected officials in Wisconsin. That's why I've chosen the political arena to make my contribution. But I've been an elected district attorney. I've had a private practice for more than 20 years. I've been a legal services attorney for low-income people, concentrating on consumer protection issues. I've worked as a professor, and I've taught negotiations, rule of law, conflict resolution in Ukraine. I was a Fulbright professor at Africa University in Zimbabwe. I have a Master's of Divinity. I was a United Methodist pastor for two churches. So I believe that I have a complex of broad experience, of educational experience, legal experience, and the ethics of my ministry that I believe I can put together for the people of Wisconsin.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob.
That's Dave Leeper. He's a Madison-based attorney, one of two Democratic candidates running for state treasurer. Now we turn to his Democratic primary opponent, David Sartori. He's a Vietnam veteran, a retired probation and parole agent. He spent 30 years working at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. He joins us now from our studio in Milwaukee. David Sartori, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be with you.
So start us off with the basics. Why do you want to be the next state treasurer here in Wisconsin?
Currently, the state treasurer's office is in absolute turmoil. Almost all the functions, with the exception of the service of the treasurer on the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, is the only real, true, meaningful function that the treasurer serves. I also would like to add, if I may, that one thing that you missed in the introduction, it's something that I'm very, very proud of personally. I am the top blood donor in the United States. I've given a little over 139 gallons since age 21. I've given whole blood, platelets. I'm on the emergency platelet list, and I would like to say that one day before the terrible terrorist bombing in Boston, I gave platelets at the Milwaukee Blood Center, and unbeknownst to me at the time, my platelets went to the lab here, and the next day the terrorist attack occurred, and Massachusetts, New England ran out of platelets, and my platelets were on the first outgoing plane to help those people who were tragically injured and sustained life-threatening, life-altering injuries.
Well, I've got some catching up to do on blood donations. Looking at the Office of the State Treasurer, there have been calls, including from one of the candidates on the Republican side in this race, to just get rid of the office completely, saying it no longer serves the purpose, if it ever did. Make the case that the state treasurer position still matters.
This is deja vu all over again. The current treasurer 4 years ago ran on a platform of eliminating the office and promising the people that if he could not successfully eliminate the office, he would not run for re-election. Well, that is the case. At least the gentleman is a man of his word. The position of Wisconsin State Treasurer is extremely critical. It is a full cabinet position elected. When you elect people, you have accountability. You have transparency. Right now, The previous speaker spoke about the backlog of unclaimed property. My sources indicate that we have officially about 7,600 property claims still pending. My information discloses that we actually have way over 10,000 and that there are boxes, sealed boxes, in the Department of Revenue that are taped and have not even been opened. This money doesn't belong to the state of Wisconsin. It belongs to the claimants. And we have an obligation to make sure that we get that money back. The Department of Revenue lusted for years to control unclaimed property. They have fallen flat on their face. I also want to make it very clear that the treasurer employees that were transferred from Wisconsin Treasurer's Office to the unclaimed unit in the Department of Revenue are being bullied, and there are attempts to intimidate them, and it's gotten to be a real terrible, terrible political mess. Our employees that were transferred to the Department of Revenue, I want them back. This is what my agenda is. Number one, I want to get our current employees, approximately five, who are in the subterranean, windowless, airless, musty basement office under the state rotunda. I want them to get out of the building. I want them to be placed in a professional business office where we can start improving morale. Once I am elected, I also want the EDVAS program returned to the treasurer. I also want the 529 EDVAS program returned, and I also want the municipal government investment pool returned. All the functions that were transferred from Treasury to Revenue, I want back. Now, believe it or not, there are four Democrats on the Joint Finance Committee. Three of the four Democrats voted with the Republicans to transfer these out. Only John Richards was the only one who stood up and said, no, they belong in the treasurer's office. And I also want to compliment Senator Glenn Grothman, who his position was that the unclaimed property should never be transferred to revenue, and that the Treasury did an outstanding job at handling unclaimed property. With an elected office, you have transparency, you have accountability. The buck stops here.
Well, the idea is, I suppose, that why should the state have two separate entities that's doing things related to money? Isn't it more efficient to wrap them up under one, in this case, the Department of Revenue?
Actually, there are more than two, if you count the Department of Financial. Well, there are more than two. One could say that it all belongs into the Treasury's office, which many states have. That has not been the situation in Wisconsin. My first goal is not pie-in-the-sky thinking. It's not to do something outlandish. It's to get these functions, get these precious, experienced, trained staff members back from the Department of Revenue under the Treasurer's Office. Now, the Department of Revenue said, all we need is a little bit more time. We're spending over $1 million on computerization. And what they aren't saying is most of the hardware and software, the vendors are all out of state. None of them are local. And I very much resent this. I mean, we have software manufacturers in Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Verona, Madison, Milwaukee. Why is it that we can't use some of our tax dollars to purchase items from Wisconsin manufacturers?
If you're elected, you'll be a Democratic state treasurer, likely with a Republican legislature. How would you work with Republican legislators to try to get some of those duties back into the department, the Treasury Department there?
First of all, I would like to encourage all the listeners to go to my website, badgersfordavesartori.com. And I want to say that I was a member of the Republican Party many years ago. I left. I became very active in the Democratic Party because of the extremism that has generated in the Republican Party. The Republican Party, in many ways, is at war with itself. I'll give you a typical example. Last year, I volunteered at the Democratic Party booth for Milwaukee County at State Fair Park. I took a break. I went down to the Republican Party booth. They were selling beautiful American flags, and it said on the front, proudly made in the, and then there was an asterisk. You turn it over, PRC. What in the world is the PRC? They were selling American flags made in communist China. Then I looked at some of the other items they were selling, T-shirts, viciously racist with Pancho Villa type of caricatures, about ready to jump over the U.S.-Mexican border. And on the American side were members of the Tea Party with shotguns and submachine guns to stop them. That's ridiculous. Did anyone ever hear of moderation and working together for a common purpose? We all elected officials, their primary purpose is to serve the people of the state of Wisconsin. Now, I've held elected office before as an alderman in Greenfield. I helped and worked very hard to bring the 911 system to Milwaukee County. I also have served on the Milwaukee County Election Commission for 4 years, and I can proudly say that I was nominated by the Democratic Party of Milwaukee County, and the county exec, who at the time was Mr. Scott Walker, appointed me. And I served for 4 years serving on the Milwaukee County Election Commission, the only election commission in the state of Wisconsin. My mother was a Republican. My sister was a Republican. The current Republican Party is not reflective of the philosophy of my sister or mother.
David, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
That's David Sartori, one of two Democratic candidates running in next week's primary for state treasurer.